The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Experiencing traumatic events can dismantle a life, with many finding it hard to continue with daily tasks. But my next guest has a different story. Her resolve is admirable. Joining me now, Bridget McLaughlin, award-winning journalist and author. This is about the release of her new memoir, Tales of a Patchwork Life, a memoir of the stories that keep me. Bridget, or Biddy, as I know you to be, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Pat.
It's an amazing book. I mean, I've known you for years and I've known some of the things you've been up to, but this is an extraordinary story.
It's been quite a journey doing it, and I'm delighted that I've parked it now. I've parked a lot of things in this book. A memoir is such a personal thing to write about, but it's given me great release. Like, I had all my notes and my diaries about my life were in the loft of my cottage, and I just found the weight of that past too heavy. So I decided to address it and to put it down in paper. And I'm in a very good place now.
Have you destroyed those notes?
Everything is gone.
Is gone.
Newspaper cuttings from the trial, my diaries, which nobody could read anyhow. Everything is gone. It's like the bin man has taken away my brain from that past.
Now, you mentioned the trial, and people not familiar with your family's history may not know this was about your beloved sister, Siobhan, or Shawnee, as you called her. You describe the first encounter your family had with her husband, the man who murdered her. And he was a bad lot from the very beginning, from the outset. That's what the family felt about him.
Absolutely. In the book, I call him the Box, because, and I also call him the Savage, because obviously the history there is obscene when we look back and beyond words. But from the very beginning, none of us could take to him at all. People say, why did Siobhan like Brian Kearney?
She met him in her place of employment in Mulhuddart, I think it
that's
was.
That's right, Yamanushi.
Yeah.
And he was head of electrics there and she was the chef. And he was much older than her. And he had a daughter she didn't know about. And I think she just, we all know people in life who are in a couple. And we often wonder, what is the attraction?
He had one virtue, if we can say that, that he was a hardworking man. And that was about it.
That was it. That was it, Pat. That was it. He was an empty vessel. There was a nothingness. Like, evil is very ordinary. We all presume it's going to be some, you know, in-your-face, dramatic kind of context to it. But evil is actually very benign looking. There's no signs. He said nothing. All he talked about was food, and which he knew little about, and money. They were his only
Now,
interests.
You describe in one scene where you're sitting beside him and you get nothing from him in by way of sociability, but he puts his head down, he puts his arms around the plate, and it's almost like a dog eating the food.
Absolutely. There was a primitiveness about him. It wasn't observed very often because he wasn't a social person. He was only in my cottage once. As they say in the country, we passed ourselves with him. What can you do? I mean, if somebody's with somebody, you just have to take it all. None of us can understand why people are connected. Siobhan, like, was such a vital spark, and he was just a nothing. He had no presence, no conversation. In the cottage that day, I remember he said one thing, like, do you know much about communism? And that was it, like, full stop. And then he talked about prawns. Siobhan was an extraordinary bright light and vivacious. She was
Do you understand why he quenched that light?
I do. I don't. Of course I don't. But I do in the terms that he's, like a lot of coercive people, he's a control freak. He's obsessed by money, and he owns, like, there's one episode in the book where it's a very good metaphor for everything, really, where I'm in Hotel Salvia and I'm sitting in the terrace and there are guests there. Siobhan is in Palma. She's going in to do the shopping and I'm at home kind of keeping everything on tack. And he arrives suddenly from Ireland, and he has his coffee and his breakfast in the kitchen, and my whole heart sinks immediately. Siobhan didn't know he was coming home. And he goes out to the garden and he has a chainsaw and he has a secateurs, and he starts to, her garden was beautiful and there was bougainvillea and jasmine, and he went over and he literally was taking everything down, literally denuding the garden of all its beauty. And that kind of is great insight into who he was.
We won't go into the detail of the killing, but it was vicious, and the tragedy was he tried to disguise it as something else entirely, leaving their child watching television And
eating a bowl of Cocoa Pops, yeah. I mean, I have actually no problem anymore. I used to have a major difficulty talking about it. But I do think it has to be always brought back, the barbarian that he was. And my parents, my mother and father, are listening this morning, and they would want to remind people that he did strangle her twice. And he did it with a Hoover, a Dyson Hoover lead. So the barbarity of that has not to be forgotten, because this is what people are capable of. And nobody in their right mind, the fragility of Siobhan and any woman, any person having to go through the last minutes of their life like that, that can't be forgotten.
Yeah, and he was hoping to get away with it the way he had constructed the tableau he left behind.
Absolutely. But even before that, Pat, Mum and my sister had gone to the house and there was a smell of gas outside the house. Like, it wasn't the first time we believed that he tried it. He was determined to get rid of her. She was beautiful. She was independent. These people don't like independent, smart, beautiful women. They just can't bear them. And she was exactly her own woman. And even though she was, you know, very fragile, she was a mother who loved her son. And he was, he was her life, like most mothers. And he came first.
Now, when people think of you, they think, Dawky, lovely cottage looking out on Collymore, absolutely fabulous. It's not where you came from. You came from the Ward, a very agricultural part of North County Dublin.
Absolutely. I'm proud to be a country woman. I really am. I mean, the platinum prairies of the Ward are like the Kansas to me.
This is the platinum when the wheat is...
when the wheat is in full bloom. The Ward, my father sold farm machinery and my mum was a great woman. Mum's from Waterford originally. Dad's Donegal, and we're all very much rooted in rural Machrane Farm.
And you'd know your way around a combine harvester.
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time in them as a child in the grain compartment, writing and doing little drawings. The country is synonymous with my whole life, and there's nothing I like more than being in the country.
Now, you were a difficult teenager.
Absolutely.
So much so you were sent away to the Brigidines.
That's right.
The Brigidines,
yes. And the Brigidiers. And it was an experience, all right. Well, in fairness to them, they were challenging. I was challenging, there's no doubt about it. Yes, meant
I mean,
no.
you went through several phases in the way you presented yourself to the world.
Oh,
still, a hippie on one day and perhaps
punk
a week
rocker.
Later.
Yeah, punk rocker. No, I was really difficult and wouldn't wish me as a teenager on anybody, really, to be honest. My parents were incredibly tolerant.
And the Brigidines, it was a tough school, but it kind of changed you into something you perhaps weren't, a reader.
No, I wasn't a reader. And in those days, the nearest thing to books would be someone selling the Encyclopaedia Britannica around the neighbourhood in the country. And look and learn encyclopaedias, that was it, right? And it brought me into a world of reading and books. And it disciplined me in a way I least expected. I mean, I really got to like it, actually. And mainly because the girls around me were from Burrs and Ossory and Thurles. And it was a totally new insight into the other parts of the country that I hadn't been to. And I loved the crack with country people. They're so relaxed and stressless, compared to...
How did your working life begin? What was your first job?
My first job actually was an ARD, the pirate radio station. And
Tony Fenton, Ian Dempsey
and the like, yes, yeah. In fact, Ian Dempsey came to my Debs, God bless him, and I wore a black dress. Can you imagine? They wouldn't take a photograph.
Were you a goth? Yeah.
And no, not a goth, but I was a kind of a glamorous kind of femme fatale, I thought in my head. I think he's still recovering from the shock. He told me recently that he had the photograph still. News talk I used to do, not in ARD, I used to do, horoscopes, totally made up horoscopes. And the crack was 90 and Peter Murter was there and Ray McGuigan and Ken Finley. Wonderful people. I mean, the same excitement and buzz that's in your office here we had, and I absolutely adored it.
Now, you ended up in Dublin City Public Libraries.
Yes.
Which was like if not a hell, a purgatory.
Absolutely, absolutely. The libraries, have they changed? I hope so. My experience wasn't great, I have to say. I was severely bullied by one librarian who's now dead. And she just, anybody creative was stunted immediately.
Was this the one who used to sunbathe topless out in the backyard of the library?
That's right. And drink her wine outside the back of the library. And I, in fact, one member of the public, he was a trainee teacher. He intervened at the desk one day and said, listen, you have to stop leaving this. He could hear her bullying me. And he said, you have to leave this girl alone. It was a horrific experience. There were good sides to it. But as I said in the book, most of the staff in libraries are overqualified. A lot of them have PhDs. They're not great on the social skills. They're still not great on the social skills. There are exceptions, of course, wonderful exceptions. But no, the library was not for me.
Now, you did things like travelling in the mobile library, and you do profess that the modern mobile library is a better thing with proper toilet built into the wagon and so on.
Yes.
But your experience was rather different.
Yes, it was, because sometimes I remember being in Kilbarrack Library and the mobile library, and in wintertime, and it was like chronically primitive conditions, and we'd plug in to Kilbarrack and sit inside, and suddenly sometimes what would happen would be these young lads would come along, like, you know, causing trouble, and they'd lock our door and they'd shake the van.
So you'd be locked in?
Locked in this horrendous, and we'd have a walkie-talkie looking for emergency help to be rescued.
And the lads were rocking the van?
Rocking the van in Kilbarrack. I'll never forget it, yeah.
Hmm. Anyway, one day, enough was enough. I mean, you were doing things like drawing pictures for the children and so on, and you were told no.
Highly creative from birth, I have to say. I was born to be an artist, and I say that modestly, by the way. I'm still doing my folk art. But at the time, I was a junior library assistant in a hierarchy of senior, extra librarians. The hierarchy was incredible, and it was run by women.
And you were down the bottom of the
pile. I was at the lowest level, just doing the Dewey system, cataloguing books, like, you know,
collecting pennies and fines.
Absolutely. I remember this woman from Terranera coming in, and she was very posh, and she said, "I've never paid a fine. My brother is a consultant in the Beacon." So I just said to her, "Well," I said, "if you can't afford it, that's fine." I said, there was mayhem, absolute mayhem. No, it was, and the things, of course, you find in books like fried eggs and rashers. And
that's why you say you never would buy or borrow a secondhand book.
No, never.
Use condoms.
There was rashers, bits of food, because it's quite grotesque. People read their books in bed. So no, I'm very wary of that. Yeah.
Now, your beginnings in journalism, you know, tentative beginnings.
Yes, yes. Well, I started off writing horrendous plays in Temple Bar, and then a friend of mine, Paddy Boyle, suggested that he was in business, and he said, contact. There was a Who's Who book in Ireland. Remember that at the time?
Maureen Kern Duff.
Maureen Kern Duff, a brilliant book. And he picked out a picture of Anne Harris, and he said, this is the woman you have to go to. So I stalked her basically outside her offices, and nervously stalked her. And many times she passed me and said, no, I have an editorial meeting. And I was very nervous and highly strung. But eventually she said, listen, I better bring you up. Who are you? And everything else. So I didn't even last long in the office. I had to run away because I was afraid of the whole thing. Terry Keane was there, very formidable, scared in my life. And so finally she saw something in me. And I adore her still. And she was my mentor.
Now, it's extraordinary the free rein she gave you. I mean, the adventures you describe, I mean, you get a lead sometimes from your very good friend, Therese Cronin.
Yes.
Who, tragically, an alcoholic, difficult, but you lived with her in
for 5
shared
years.
Accommodation.
Yes.
You were in digs with her.
In digs with her, yes. Yeah.
And you'd get a lead, for example, heading to London to meet whoever it might be, Lord Oran Moran Brown, most famously,
yes,
I suppose.
Yes.
And to Paris with them. And she gave you a long leash.
Oh, my God. I mean, I wish she was still my editor. Not that I have a good editor, of course. But,
of course.
Of course. But it was a different time. I mean, trust is incredible. And when someone trusts you and they look after you, financially as well, by the way, because journalism is a very poorly paid profession. But when they look after you and respect you, you respect them and you work twice as hard. And a lot of journalists now, they go through journalist college, which I'm really against, as you know. And I just feel that you should work in a provincial paper and learn everything. But I had freedom that nobody had. Like, I could go, even we went on a trip once past.
Went to Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes, yes.
And you then headed off.
I headed off down to
Mississippi. On a Greyhound bus or something, down to deepest Mississippi on your own.
Yes, because I had an obsession with Huckleberry Finn. And I went down and ended up in Carville, Louisiana at a leprosy colony. You see, you have to take every chance you can in life.
Yeah. I ended up one time in Natchez, Mississippi, singing in the choir on a Sunday morning in a Baptist church.
Well,
but
you
that's
know,
another story.
You know what it's like then. It's just the kind of the lure of, I mean, curiosity is a great thing. And once you're hardness towards curiosity, you manage to find the most extraordinary situations. But Anne Harris, I can never thank enough, because she really set me free.
Now, when I look at you, you're a delicate person, you know, although you're tough, and we know that too. And the idea of you being fascinated by boxing.
Yes.
Was something I did not know.
Yes, a lot of people don't know that. Well, as I grew up, when I saw the Rumble in the Jungle when I was like, you know, very young, and it was not really the actual, I'm not an expert on boxing, but it was that dichotomy between you have this rope in the ring and on one side you have this kind of this dedicated, you know, seriously loner athletes, and on the other side you have every
retrograde
scoundrel hooker on the other side, and it was the kind of this absolute, you know, dichotomy of human life that fascinated me. And when I worked in Punch magazine, another Peter McKay was my editor, and the Americans thought that Punch was a boxing magazine.
So you got a front row seat.
I got a front row seat, and that's how, you know, that's why the boxing coverage continued. But I absolutely loved Las Vegas.
Now, you actually sought out George Foreman.
Yes, yes. Myself and my sister and Eve went down to Humble in Texas. There was no Google Maps then, I can tell you, right? So long taxi drives. And we arrived and we went to his church, talking about your church in Natchez. We went to his church and he was an extraordinary man. And we, pure, like, we had no contacts. We went to the house first and the security guard said, you might find him in the church. We triggered down to the church and we met all his children, George, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
They're all called George.
George, yeah. And I was interested in a sermon because he gave a sermon, and the sermon was about hamburgers and God. Now, I'd never been to a sermon where people talked about food so much, and I was in my element because I'm obsessed with food myself. And I then, you now understand why he, you know, he created the George Foreman Grill. But he was a fabulous man, and his wife as well.
And he had read Angelus Ashes.
Yes, and he loved Angelus Ashes. You see, people abroad, they really do like Irish writers. And there's an, you know, Ireland has such creative talent. I was really impressed by that. Do you know why he liked Angelus Ashes? Because it was about poverty.
Yeah.
And he knew about poverty. And he knew that when he was a child, they'd have a hamburger between eight of them, divided into
so
that.
His mother wanted them all to taste the hamburger, but could only afford one.
Exactly, exactly.
And his female child, by the way, is Georgette.
Georgette, right? Yes, yes, yes.
It's all the Georges and the Georgette. Now, we cannot have this interview without talking about Michael, the love of your life.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's a love story which obviously, as we know, had a tragic ending.
Yes, yes. I feel you only really know love once in your life, if you're lucky, sometimes twice. Who knows, Pat, there might be a twice, but at the moment there was a once. And he had a profound effect on me because I'm quite a highly strung extroverted introvert, became an extrovert person, but he was very calm, and he was a wine importer and businessman, and he was widowed 12 years when I met him, and he introduced me to a much calmer, kind of wonderful, calm, happy existence.
At that time, your cottage was in the process of being rehabilitated.
Absolutely, absolutely. And
there's a thing about your cottage, by the way, anyone who's passed it knows it has a half door.
Yes.
And I was fascinated to learn that your father had to measure you so that the half door to be manufactured in Donegal would suit your height so that you could lean over the half door.
Exactly, with a piece of string, yes. So the half door, as one woman said in with the drinks on her years ago, it's to keeps the cocks out and the hens in. And of course, that's in rural agricultural talk, of course, nothing else. Mm. But
the official version is to keep the children in and the animals out.
Absolutely.
But anyway, we'll park that.
Yeah.
Anyway, you and Michael, you live in a sort of an Airbnb of the hotel that's actually being demolished at the time.
Dalkey Island Hotel.
Yeah.
We were joined. I was living with my parents when the house was being done up, the cottage, and obviously a bit of romance had started. I was mad about him, absolutely stark crazy from the minute I met him. And I saw him talking to an old lady in Finnegan's with my sister, and that's how I met him, in Finnegan's. And he was just kind of tall, handsome, looked like Rock Hudson, and very suave, but not too suave. And he had a bit of fate about him, and he had Jane, his daughter, who was Down syndrome. And I always craved a family unit. So from the minute I met him, we had this kind of unique little setup. And then he said to me, he called me Buzzy, because I'm always buzzing around. And he said, let's move into the Dalkey Island Hotel, just for, you know, get away from everybody.
Yeah.
And we did, and it was magical. And he put up a Christmas tree in the room, and the hotel has been demolished all around us.
All around you,
all
yeah.
around us, yeah.
It's an extraordinary story, and you know, it's a love story. It's like a pre-honeymoon, that particular period.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He died tragically, but kind of not once, but twice.
Twice, yes, because first of all, he had a drowning accident on Rock White Rock Beach, and
he was
there. I was he was rescued. It was horrific. It was pure terror, Pat, pure terror. And there was nobody. I was screaming on the beach trying to find people, somebody who could swim. And a lot of people can't swim. So young, these four young, fantastic guys from Dunluce Road in Dalkey, they saved him. And he ended up, and we had a big party for him to come home. And we had, you know, life bands and big celebration. And it was just such a relief that he was alive. And then sadly then, it happened again. Happened this time again. He died. Yeah.
And had you been cautioning him against going swimming?
Of course,
on his own?
Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. He was a very relaxed man. Like, he would swim on his back. He was incredibly relaxed. And that personality, you know, they don't really take, you know, procrastination or anything. He just said, Buzzy, I'm grand.
I mentioned that you're resilient. I mean, to recover from Michael's death. You never really recover from a loss like that, but you live with that loss.
Absolutely. The hammers of change and the hammers of shocks to the system in my life have been profound. But I have survived, and I have a great sense of mischief still about me, and you have to live with some sort of humour and joy, otherwise you'd never navigate that territory.
We could talk all day, but I don't want to because I want people to read the book. It's a fabulous memoir. I mean, the stories of another love, perhaps, of your life, Rich Hall, the comedian,
yes,
the stand-up.
And yes.
You were stood up by a stand-up.
I was, yes, yes, yes. Okay.
So much to read in the book. It's really enjoyable. Tales of a Patchwork Like Life, a memoir of the stories that keep me, by Bridget McLaughlin, available everywhere. And Biddy, thank you very much for joining us
programme
this morning.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.